is brought to you by Head Start Basketball.
We identified early on that we would go through existing organizations to reach the coaches in those organizations to have an impact on as many children as we can through the coach. So by and large, everybody bought into the coaching component. And so I think you're seeing that now with our coach license program, which we launched in like mid-2015. But if we can educate and train coaches and onboard them and have communication points with them, they're really the people that deliver the game. And everybody got behind that concept. And so that became our first program.
Jay Demings joined USA Basketball as Youth and Sport Development Division Director on November 4th, 2013. He arrived at USA Basketball with 16 years of experience in boys and girls basketball and a master's degree in sport leadership from Northeastern University. As the Youth and Sport Development Division Director, Demings oversees all facets of the department, including the development of youth basketball initiatives that address player development, coach education, and safety in sport. Prior to arriving at USA Basketball, Demings served as the Director of Operations for the Boston Amateur Basketball Club in Boston, Massachusetts, where he oversaw all aspects of the nonprofit basketball program. During his tenure, BABC won 5 national tournament titles as well as the 2012 Victor Roe International Basketball Tournament in Milan, Italy, at the U16 age group. He also organized and directed many youth basketball tournaments. From May of 2011 through August of 2012, Demings was a sport director at Boys and Girls Clubs of America in Warwick, Rhode Island, and he spent the 2009-2010 NBA season with the Boston Celtics as a media and public relations assistant. At Providence Country Day School in East Providence, Rhode Island from 2003 to 2008, Demings served as an assistant athletic director and the varsity girls basketball coach for 5 seasons. Demings got his start in high school basketball as founder, president, and coach of Rhode Island Premier Basketball from 1998 to 2009, a nonprofit youth program for boys and girls ages 9 through 18. After you're done enjoying this episode, please leave us a 5-star rating and review on iTunes, and make sure you're subscribed so you never miss an episode. The Hoopheads Pod can be found on iTunes, Spotify, SoundCloud, Stitcher, Google Play, and YouTube. Share the show with one friend or colleague so we can continue to grow the great game of basketball. Get ready to learn and make sure you take some notes as we dive into a conversation with Jay Demings from USA Basketball.
Hello and welcome to the Hoopheads Podcast. It's Mike Klinzing here with my co-host Jason Sunkel. And tonight we are pleased to welcome from USA Basketball, Jay Demings. Jay, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, guys. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. We are excited to dive a little deeper into all the great things that you're doing with USA Basketball and want to get started here, though, by going back in time and talking about how you got into the game of basketball as a kid and what made you fall in love with the game as a young person.
Yeah, that's great. I'm getting a little older now, so to recall those years is getting a little tougher. But if I remember correctly, and I tell this story a lot, so I do remember this. For me, I didn't even know I was playing basketball when I first fell in love with the game. It probably started the same way it starts for most of us, I would think, where you end up taking like a sock or a piece of paper and either, throwing the sock in a laundry basket or the piece of paper in a waste basket, before you know it, you're kind of making a little bit of a game of it. And then you have a sibling or some relative that comes over and tries to block that shot or knock a hair on you and you get frustrated and you try to figure out ways to make it happen and you get further and further back and before you know it, you're playing basketball. And I think we start very, very early, whether we know it or not. And I don't think a lot of sports can say that. But I didn't actually play organized basketball until I got a lot older. So a lot older, relatively speaking, like 13 or 14. So that's the first time I ever went and played on the team. I was that kid that double dribbled out on the playground and didn't know he was doing it, but thought he was really good until I got into somebody put a uniform on me. So I was a typical kid where I probably thought I knew more than I actually did. And so I didn't necessarily take coaching that well. So it didn't lead me down the high school path like it did maybe some of my other friends. But then I really started to pick it up. And so I kind of started to play on my own in different leagues and things like that. back then what was called AAU basketball, or, you know, travel basketball now mostly, wasn't as popular as it was. So if you weren't as good as some of the other players, you didn't have a team you could play on. Today you do. There's a team for every level and every ability, but back then there wasn't. So, but I tried working really hard. I went and played before they were actually a college team. They had a club team at Johnson & Wales University in Rhode Island. And I kind of started playing there after a shoulder injury. And the fact that my mom was about 4'11", I decided I was going to give it up and get into the coaching side. So that's what I did.
Gotcha. Did you play other sports growing up?
I tried them. I tried soccer. I tried baseball. The infamous story is that when I tried baseball, I was on a pretty good team. Back then, you could stack teams. So my neighbor's dad coached the team, and he picked me on the team. I wasn't very good. I was pretty fast, but I couldn't hit a ball. My baseball career ended when Scott Monahan, I'll never forget the name, who was bigger than the rest of the kids at 11 and 12 years old, drilled me with a pitch my first year when, you know, they took the tee away, I guess, and hit me in the back, took off my helmet, gave it back to my friend's dad and said, thank you so much for the opportunity, coach. And then I ended my baseball career.
Back to the hardwood after that, right?
That's back. Yeah, exactly.
Absolutely. So as you were going through and you were growing up, before you gave up your playing career, did you have aspirations or thoughts of coaching at any point while you were still playing? Or was that something that once you came to the realization that, hey, my playing career is over, I got my shoulder injury, I think I'm going to hang up the sneakers, was that the point that you started to think about coaching, or had you thought about it previously?
Yeah, I thought about it previously. Well, I always thought I was a coach because I thought I knew more than any of the coaches. So I kind of thought, hey, I can do what they're doing. And when my playing career, I still played with friends and that I grew up with.
Right, right.
Like we all play. But like, so I kept playing. But I realized pretty quick that, like, let me go back to see if I can teach young people what I didn't learn at that same age. So I went back and I decided to take a small group of like 6th and 7th graders, which is right about where I thought maybe I could have used some better guidance and some more like relatable coaching. And so I took a small little 6th and 7th grade team and I in town, like a town league team, you know, like where any kid that signs up plays. And I just coached in a little league season where they had, you know, everybody plays, rules and things like that. And to be quite honest, I used to, at that point, I was only 18, actually 17 when I first took my team. I used to try to find a way to circumvent the rules of the league to work in my favor, so I could, you know, so if they said it's 3 minutes of playing time, I was playing.
Hey, I've seen this guy before, Jay. I've seen this guy you're describing.
Yep.
Name's James.
So, you know, I would, you know, and we won, and we won some games. And, you know, of course, then you become the new guy on the block and this young coach trying to make an impression. And, you know, these little, and then plus these kids are, you know, I think that time 10, 11 and 12. So I, you know, I thought I was the best coach in the world. But that's how I got started in it. And then I got bitten by the bug.
What did you like about it when you first did that and when you had that experience? What was it about the coaching that you loved?
Yeah, I think it was, I think it was the opportunity to sort of shape the game a little bit. And so like you could get, I mean, as strategic as you can get with 11-year-olds, you know, you could put them in positions where they were successful. And then so you could see the result of what you were working on. In some cases, obviously, they were young. But, you know, whether it be that we won a game or that a player made their first shot or that they simply got over their nerves about getting on the court for the first time, you feel a sense of responsibility to the game, obviously, but to the players most importantly. And I think that that is what made me seek out numerous other coaching opportunities after that. Of course, I was competitive, and that was a way to stay competitive, too, you know, within basketball. Yeah, for me, it was, you know, seeing the results of the volunteer time that we were putting in, because we were all volunteers, you know, back then.
Absolutely. So besides circumventing the rules, What was something else that you remember from that first year, that first couple experiences coaching, that you look back on now and you're like, whew, I don't know if that was really that good of an idea, or maybe you're doing something that now you look at it and you're like, oh, I wish I would have tried this differently back in that time.
Mm-hmm. I think it was my attitude back then. And by the way, that didn't like eradicate for a good decade. So, it wasn't just that year, but it was my attitude toward people who, basically I had this competitive attitude, just like I did when I played, because I was short. We all have that short person syndrome. A lot of us do anyway. And so you feel like people are trying to keep you in a box or whatever. So when we would win games, I'm talking about a rec league, but people would start to say, oh, you need to take it easy on the other team, or you need to, and I used to think, well, that person doesn't know what they're talking about. You should try to win by as much as you can and use every advantage you can. And so if I had to look back at it, or when I look back at it now, if I had to do it all over again, if I could, I would have changed that part of my attitude and realized what we were supposed to be there for. Cause I don't think I wasn't mature enough, I guess, to be able to understand the responsibility that I was given.
So was that a gradual change then, or was that something that you had a moment where you suddenly realized that, something happened and boom, you decided, oh, I gotta get this ego in check and realize what the purpose of me being out here is? Or was that something that just kind of gradually changed over time?
I think there were two moments where it changed. So I went on to coach like a low level club team, where I took a couple of kids from all those different teams in that league I was coaching in, and kind of went and played them in quote unquote AAU tournaments. They, at that time, we lost every game by 70, by the way, so, tournament. And so then I went and tried to find better players, better teams, whatever, and so I went on to coach. I still coached in the league. I coached in Catholic Youth League, still kind of overly competitive. I still was competitive back then. But it changed for me when I started to coach girls basketball for the first time in high school. And it really only changed for me because I was the assistant athletic director at a prep school where I was coaching at the time. And so my job was tied to my attitude. And so, that's when you realize that, oh, actually, I have to listen to the people telling me what to do here. And so I won't say I softened my stance as a coach, but I gained some perspective, if you will, and that helped me. And coaching girls actually helped me. And it was probably one of the best experiences I've ever had, because I realized then that it's not about wins and losses. I could still manipulate the game to so that the scoreboard favored us at the end of the day, but winning more so in their lives and off the court, and still some on court wins as well, but it's more about the individual athlete than it was about me and wins. And so it started there. And then when I ended up coaching I was actually director of operations for the Boston Amateur Basketball Club, or the BABC, which is on the Nike EYBL circuit. We had a pretty high level team. And when I realized that my job wasn't about winning games or trying to become a college coach through, by utilizing those players to get me there, and it was truly about them and their experiences and them going on to play in college and giving them that opportunity, I think those two moments really like shaped me and actually helped me probably get to where I am today as an administrator.
Yeah, I think when you're given a chance to have a diversity of experiences, which obviously just from what you described, you've had the opportunity to do so, starting at the youth level and then going to work with girls at the high school level and then going back and do it on the EYBL, where obviously you're working with some pretty good players at that level that have aspirations of playing college basketball or even beyond that. I think that diversity of experiences just allows you to be able to gain a different perspective about why you're there. I want to circle back to the girls, to coaching the girls, because that's one of the things that I really had not spent a whole lot of time coaching girls. I coached my daughter, who's now a freshman in high school. I had coached a couple of her lower level rec games when she was in third, fourth, fifth grade, but I never really coached the girls at a higher level. And then as she started playing, and the team's not super high level that I'm coaching now with my daughter, but I found it to be super interesting that, like you said, having an impact on their lives, there's so much more, in my experience, the girls were so much more receptive to some of those things, especially out of the gate. Like, you can get boys to buy in, but it takes a little bit more time. Mm-hmm. And my experience with the girls was just that they really, really bonded. And the group that I've been able to put together and been fortunate enough to be a part of, has just developed great friendships with, for my daughter. And, you know, these are kids that are going to be friends with her for the rest of her life. And that was something that was eye-opening for me on the girls' side, as opposed to the boys. And so it's interesting to hear you say that the girls had a similar impact on you in terms of just how you were approaching the winning versus the impacting lives, you know, both on and off the floor.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So if you think about that diversity of experiences that you've had, and eventually as you go through the process and you are looking around for opportunities, how does the opportunity with USA Basketball come to your front door? How do you get that? How do you get that opportunity?
Sure. I can be honest with you. I wasn't looking for it. I know that seems like cliche or whatever. But looking back, I think I know actually how it came about. And in all honesty, it was a lot of the experiences that I had gained just by organically staying involved in the game and doing it for the right reasons. And so there wasn't like my pathway anyway, it wasn't like a set path. When I was debating whether or not I wanted to get into coaching at a higher level, that kind of led me to the BABC program. I went back to school, so I went to grad school at Northeastern at the time, and so I went to go get my master's degree in sport leadership, and that led me to the Boston Celtics, where I first interned and then sort of worked, finished out our run in 2009-2010, but I worked in media, and so I was trying to keep my foot in the coaching door. I was keeping my foot in the administrative side, getting my master's degree in hopes that, hey, look, you know, if this coaching thing doesn't work out, you know, it's a tough gig. It's a tough racket, especially if you're looking to get into, let's say, you know, men's Division I anyway.
For sure.
Even women's now. So I was trying to kind of keep my foot in different avenues. And so, you know, whether it be media or marketing or whatever. So just to stay well-rounded, I thought I could become a college athletic director, if nothing else, you know, work my way up through those ranks. And so as I was going through all of that, one thing led to another. I actually took a position as the general manager of a multi-sport complex in Massachusetts, and they were going through some trials and tribulations for the business. And so when I came in, it was like a reclamation project, and I've always found that I find reclamation projects, or they find me. And if it's not a reclamation project, it's a starter project, you know. And so
gotcha.
And so when I, you know, while I was kind of finishing up grad school, I was job hunting, and I throw my hat in the ring on a couple of different positions like that, you know, just to stay involved in sports, colleges, that private facility job. And USA Basketball was a job that had kind of come up. And to be honest, when the position was posted, it was very ambiguous. It was called the youth program director. I think it was director, it might have even been coordinator or something at the time. But I found out it was ambiguous on purpose, because USA Basketball hadn't had any youth initiatives by and large, aside from our junior national team, which was even sort of new at that time. But unlike USA Hockey, US Soccer, other governing bodies, you know, we weren't in the youth space. We just focused on forming teams, or they just focused on forming teams for international competition. So the job was ambiguous because there was no department, there was no division, there was no precedent. So I had applied for that, hadn't heard back for months, and then randomly, right when I'm settling into that, you know, that GM position there in Massachusetts, I got a call for an interview, and that started me down a process of about a four to five month interview process. As you both probably know, you know, we're governed by our board of directors. And so making up that board of directors are folks from the NBA, the NCAA, National Junior College, the AAU, National Federation of High School. So you go through those interviews, you know, with a subset of those groups or representatives from those groups. And so it was a long process. And as I started to go through it, I started to realize, oh, they're actually looking to start an entirely new division here. And it's the real deal. And I think probably why I ended up getting to this point, because I know for sure there are a lot of great candidates. I know that, just as worthy and certainly just as qualified. I think what made me as qualified anyway is that my experiences. So like I was telling you about 10 and 11 year old basketball through low-level club basketball, high-level club basketball, had some experience with the NBA, with the Celtics on the media side, had a cup of coffee as a political communications consultant as well. So I think that maybe helped me along too. And of course, you know, my education, coaching side and some relationships I had made. So I think that all went into it and made me a good candidate. And then I think I ultimately got offered the position because I laid out a pretty decent vision, I think, that we're still using today.
Yes, that's what I was going to ask you, is obviously when you're going through and you're talking to all those diverse groups, they don't all have the same necessarily vision or thought process for what they might have wanted this to be. So was a lot of the interview process just you talking through with them kind of what the vision was, whether that was your vision, their vision, a shared vision? Was that kind of what the process was like?
That's exactly right. It was a little, so when, you know, when you, you know, you typically go into an interview, particularly if it's a, you know, with a high level company or something, there's a lot of information available that you can sort of read up on and, hey, you know, what are they trying to do here? What have they done in the past? What would they like to do? There was none of that. So a lot of it was, sort of open dialogue, Q&A about what they wanted this program to be. The problem with that is you get that information while you're on the phone, so you can't really study up on it. So the reaction to them, you know, could have been just telling them what they maybe wanted to hear. And they all did have a little different idea of where this program could go. But so I kind of flipped it a little bit and said, look, I know people in that space. I know what the space is calling for. This isn't my vision. This is the vision or a compilation of all of our thoughts. Like, you know, it's no secret what's wrong with youth basketball. Maybe the secret isn't, or maybe the plan on how to fix it can be disagreed upon, but we all know what the issues are by and large. And so I took that route during the interview process, and I told them, look, this is what I, and when I say I mean we, the space, believes the issues are. This is what I think, me personally, we could do to fix some of them. Again, that's learned over time by speaking to folks like yourself and others. And then, you know, and I put that out there, and I said, if you think that this will work, then I think I'm the right fit for here. And if you don't think this will work, then I'm probably not the person for you, because that's how I would do it, and that's what I think needs to be done. And so, and I repeated that. I don't know how many interviews I went on. I spoke with maybe eight, something like that. So I repeated it all eight times. And for anybody that's out there listening and going through similar experiences or job, you know, the job hunt or interview process, I think it's a great way to go, because if and when you do get that position, you get it in an authentic, real way. And then when we do have challenges and strifes and things like that, you can always call back upon the fact that you can always call back on honesty and authenticity. And I think that's who I showed during the interview process. And I think that's what I've tried to maintain. And it's been pretty effective. And so I think ultimately that's why I am blessed, really, and honored to be able to serve in this role.
Absolutely. So I want to ask you, off of that, what were some of the things that at that time, because obviously, as you said, there was no division here. There wasn't anything that you could go back to or point to and say, this is what was done in the past. So what were some of the things that you laid out at that time that you're starting to see come to fruition today? Mm-hmm. Now let's start there, and then we can come back to maybe some things that you laid out that are still works in progress.
Yeah. Well, the cupboard wasn't completely bare in the sense of we had some knowledge of some things that didn't work. And I don't know if you both remember this, but there was an organization called iHoops that was started back in 2007-ish, 6-ish. And iHoops was a joint initiative between the NBA and the NCAA that was initially designed to fix some problems in, quote unquote, problems in youth basketball. And that organization, I'll come back to the organization itself, but it was started because USA Basketball back in 2002 lost and had a poor showing at the World Championships on our own home soil in Indianapolis, Indiana. I think we finished sixth or seventh in our own tournament at the FIBA, the World championships. And then that led to 2004, which was the Olympics. We only obtained the bronze medal. But bigger than that, at that point, there was a little bit of a culture shift, or what some of the folks at the NBA and the NCAA had thought was a culture shift in basketball, and it needed to be course corrected. And what came out of that was that iHoops organization. And so initially back then, if you probably remember this, that's when USA Basketball underwent a little bit of a change. Jerry Colangelo, who was the owner, or the former owner of the Phoenix Suns, came in as our chairman. And Coach K, Coach Krzyzewski, came in as our men's national team head coach. Our women have been wildly successful for years. And but on the men's side, I'm speaking, which is probably right, one of our more notable programs, at least to the general public. They all thought that any youth development initiative should fall under USA Basketball. But David Stern, who was the commissioner of the NBA at the time, and Miles Brand, who was the president of the NCAA at the time, decided that since the NCAA and the NBA had really never worked together before, that they would stick to forming this youth initiative, which they named iHoops. And the interesting thing about iHoops, aside from the fact that it was supposed to fix a lot of the world's problems, is that it was a for-profit organization. It was actually a few different organizations that they formed. There was a marketing division. There was sort of a digital property. And then they had an office, an administrative office in Indianapolis. And so they received some funding from Adidas and Nike at that time, which at that time were the only two players sort of in basketball. The NCAA and the NBA both contributed some funding. I believe they hired about 20 people. They spun up that office and they were going to figure out what they wanted to be. And I tell you that story. And then a few years later, they had some great programs, really good people that worked for them. But I think what they lacked was a vision and a game plan of who they were and what they wanted to be before they went out into the space. And so anyway, the program itself didn't work out. It came full circle. It came back to USA Basketball, and David Stern had, you know, approached now Jerry Colangelo, and we took on that initiative. We sunsetted the iHoops brand. We inherited what was left of their assets. So that would have been any partnerships and their digital website. We closed the office down, and unfortunately some people, lost their positions, but I think they all learned from that was that we needed to do things differently. So fast forward, when I came in late 2013 and really early 2014, my charge was going to look remarkably different than the iHoops charge. First of all, we weren't going to have the money that iHoops had because it was coming off some down times.
Right.
You know, we weren't going to have a staff of 20, and we weren't going to just be allowed to throw some stuff against the wall and see if it sticks. So we really had to come up with a pretty good game plan, and essentially that's what I did my first year.
So give us one thing that you came in with an idea that everybody that you talked to, or at least most everybody, was sold on, saying, "Hey, that's a great idea. Let's get right to work on that."
That's an easy one. That was well, to give you a little explainer, like, we weren't, again, I talk about resources, we weren't going to be able to have unlimited resources where we could go out and try to reach every child and every parent in the country. So the way to get to children and parents and to improve our game, when I say improve our game, I mean, you know, like showing them, you know, a better way to play the game, you know, less right, games, more focus on skill development, things like that. But to show everybody to do that is going to be tough to reach those folks. So we identified early on that we would go through existing organizations to reach the coaches in those organizations to have an impact on as many children as we can through the coach. So by and large, everybody bought into the coaching component. And so I think you're seeing that now with our coach license program, which we launched in like really mid 2015. But if we can educate and train coaches and onboard them and have communication points with them, they're really the people that deliver the game. And everybody got behind that concept. And so that became our first program.
Registration is now open at www.headstartbasketball.com for this summer's Head Start Basketball Camps. We'll be hosting camps this summer in Strongsville, Westlake, Avon Lake, Oberlin, Brunswick, Highland Heights, Mentor, and Hudson. At Head Start Basketball, we care deeply about making a positive impact on the lives of young basketball players, both on and off the court. It's through building strong relationships with our players, parents, and coaching staff that we are able to use the game of basketball to enrich the lives of those we interact with, both inside and outside of our organization. We believe that our attention to detail, our growth mindset, and our commitment to lifelong learning allows us to help our players achieve their fullest potential. We are passionately committed to providing players, parents, and coaches with everything they need to reach their goals. These core values run through everything we do. Check out our website, www.headstartbasketball.com, and discover why you should attend a Head Start Basketball Camp this summer. Hope to see you there.
So where are you in terms of the penetration of that program and getting coaches licensed? Like, where do you feel you are in that process in getting to as many coaches as you possibly can? Are you 25% there? Are you 75% there? Where do you think you are in terms of making sure that coaches are going out and doing that?
Well, let's see. So if I don't know if you have this stat, but we work closely with the Aspen Institute and their Project Play initiative. And yes. The Aspen Institute will say that there are actually 2.5 million people coaching youth basketball in the United States. And right now, of those most of them are parent coaches, obviously, and volunteers and what have you. Right now, we have about 30,000 licensed coaches in our database, which is about a little over 1%. So we want all 2.5 million to have a coach license. Now, we won't ever get there, and that's okay. But the premise is that we can provide an offering. Look, and by the way, I should stipulate this. A coach license isn't going to make you, you know, a Hall of Fame coach. It's going to give all of us a base level from which we can build upon. So, and more importantly, it gives the organization that our children are playing in and the parents of those children some satisfaction that the coaches are at least background screened monthly by the national governing body. They have some child abuse and sexual abuse training. And then they have some base principles by how to communicate with young people, right? Like you know, teaching versus criticizing, things like that. So that's what it really is. And so, you know, for those 30,000, at least they belong to a community, a credible community, if not a qualified community of people doing things the right way. And I think that's our biggest takeaway from it. But we do want all 2.5 million.
So I'm going to say two things. One, it's great stuff. When I first, fourth year. I think I did it the very first year. So however many years the program's been in existence, you know, I jumped on board with it. And awesome. For any coach that's out there listening, it's well worth the time and effort and money that you put into it to be able to associate with yourself with USA Basketball, but just from the quality of the content and what you're going to learn through that, even if you're an experienced coach, I think it's tremendously valuable. And so then the next question that I would ask you is, and this is the thing that I think, if I think about how I'd like to see youth basketball continue to change and evolve, and I think it's great that USA Basketball is leading the charge, because I think it's the perfect organization that has nothing but the good of the game in mind. So I always find that the biggest challenge when you're trying to make a change is, how do we continue to educate A, coaches about the importance of getting it? B, how do we start to educate parents to, let's say, look for coaches who are licensed or who have the necessary background in order to be able to coach? And obviously, like you said, a lot of that 2.8 million are volunteer parent coaches. And so that's always, you know, presents a challenge of how much time are those people going to be willing to invest in, you know, in coach education. But I know I've talked to John O'Sullivan from the Changing the Game Project. I don't know if you're aware of John, but he does a lot of work trying to, again, across all sports, just educate coaches about the need for education and organizations. And one of his things is that he really believes, and he's seen it work in different sports, where when coaches are offered education and given, you know, a basic set of information, kind of like what we're describing here, it makes them want to come back and coach again because now they feel like they have some level of skill, some level of knowledge, some level of being able to do a good job for the kids, which is what they, you know, which is what they want to do. So what, in your mind, what's the vision going forward for continuing to educate parents and coaches on the value of the coaching license?
Yeah. If I'm being completely honest, the vision is that we understand that those 2.5 million coaches are coaching within organizations that predominantly, not all of them, but the majority of them have some sort of mechanism in place. And I'm talking about like municipal leagues and Boys and Girls Clubs and YMCA. So like people that have some level of accountability to someone, whether it be a board or a, you know, a town council or city council or something like that. And so a lot of those coaches live and reside in those units. And so when we go to promote the license program, you know, we try to sell them on the benefits and the value to them, right? Because there's a you know, a little less liability that you've got somebody else doing a thorough screen. By the way, our screens are not just like where you, you know, the equivalent of a Google search. These are like some pretty in-depth. And as you probably know, Mike, with, you know, if you've, now that you've gone through it, it's, gets easier every time you do it. But, you know, we go back a few years on your background screen.
For sure.
And we look and we, you know, if you've had a cup of coffee in New York, but you live in New Jersey, we're going to know about it. And, you know, so, but to back to your point, really, there are three reasons why people want to do this, the coaching license program. It's A, because they love USA Basketball. They followed the dream team when they were a kid and they just want to be associated. And that's okay, right. That's cool. We'll take those people. B, which is sort of the organic reason, they actually like the tools and the resources that we're putting out and they find value in it. Or C, somebody told them they had to do it. And whatever your reason is, we'll take them all. But by and large, the folks that, you know, the people that adopt our program are the ones that do it because somebody, it's a mandate, basically. And so, you know, we go through existing organizations, but as we're trying to sell the license, what you can imagine what we hear back is, hey, you know, we've had this great program. We do this for 20 years. We vet all of our coaches. Or, look, I can't have my soccer coach doing one thing and my basketball coach doing another background screen. So, you know, then it's just a matter of time. Can we get them on the same background screen system? Things like that to adopt this. And it's a legitimate thing. You can't have the tennis coach doing one thing and then they coach basketball in the winter doing another. So they have their own screening program. So what we're looking to offer now is the next iteration of the license. And so for certain groups, and this will be available this fall. Look, if they're not going to adopt the license, you know, which right now it's a lot of club programs, as you can imagine, and summer type programs that do it. But if they're not going to adopt the license, what else can we offer them? Can we at least offer them the base courses so that they can at least have the education and the training piece of it? And we think we're going to be able to do that extremely affordably. But not only that, we think we're going to be able to do it dynamically. And so our e-learning program that we're, it's a certificate program that we're coming up with, will be offered this fall to large scale groups that already have and can prove that they have a more robust vetting process of their own. And then they'll be able to come into USA Basketball and not only be able to offer an e-learning program back to its in-house, you know, their league coaches, but they're going to be able to tell us what courses they'd like their coaches to take. So, and I'm getting long-winded, but for example, the Boys and Girls Club in New York, I'm just making this up. You know, what might be important to them is the safe sport component or some sort of safety component and a how to speak with parents, you know, course. And so maybe their certificate is those two courses for that league. Maybe in Phoenix, Arizona, the league out there at the YMCA league might be something different. It might be, yeah, the how to communicate with parents course, but it also might be how to fundraise or, you know, something like that. I'm making it up. And so we're looking at dynamic e-learning certification that we can offer to these people who they're not going to get the license anyway, but at least they can get some sort of education and training from the governing body.
Yeah, that's great. I think what you do there is also you get them in the door and you get them exposed to the content. You get them exposed to what you guys are doing. You get them exposed to something that they may not have had any experience with before. And now they see the content, they see the value of it, and suddenly maybe they do want to come back and get more involved, whether that's through the license program or just, you know, getting on board with the guidelines and all that stuff. It just seems like it's a great way to go back to what my original question was about: how do you continue to engage more and more people to understand the value of it? And I think that's one of the things that I'm still finding as, you know, as a coach who has a license and as someone who runs, you know, a summer camp program. And this year, for the first time, to your point, is I've been mandating to the coaches that are going to work, who are adults that are going to work for me this summer, that they're going to get their license. And I've done it for the reasons that you described, and I'm anxious for the day where that designation holds value, mm-hmm. not just with the coaches and for the content, but where it also holds value for parents out there who say, oh, I want to be involved at this program because their coaches are USA Basketball certified, and yeah. where there's that piece of it, where there's recognition of the program by the parents. And I don't know how close we are to that or aren't to that, but I think you're starting to see it more. Let's put it this way: compared to 2 or 3 years ago, I know that there's way more people that are aware of that than there used to be, for sure.
Yeah. And I'll tell you this, I think the best call I ever received since being here — we get a lot of calls from a lot of people, and, you know, most of them are excited about their kid got invited to camp or something like that. And they should be, and that's great. But the best call we ever got was that it was from a parent, and her child was playing on a court in a, you know, in a multi-court event space, I guess. And we got a call, and it was a complaint. And it wasn't even about her child, her son's coach. It was about a coach on a different court. And what she noticed is that coach was wearing their USA Basketball license, loud and proud. And but what the coach did was he started to act up. He flipped out on officials. He was throwing chairs. He was doing, you know, just, you know, right. people, but, you know,
say no more.
Yeah. And so and allegedly punched or brushed or pushed a player. I forget what it was. Now, we had no video evidence and we didn't have a name to go by. But actually, we were able to find out what the event was, what time the court was, the game was, and then go back to the schedule and the event organizer, who, by the way, did not require the license. This is in 2016. Nobody really required it at that time. This was a guy that had done this voluntarily. But because she noticed that he was a licensed coach, she now had a place to call. And I think that's a big factor that we can't overlook, that who did you call before? Yeah, you could call the tournament operator if you could find out who they were and, you know, get a hold of them.
Good luck with that.
Yeah, right. And then don't forget who they take their check from, you know. And
right, yeah, for exactly. sure.
Yeah. So that was one of the best calls I'd ever received. And trust me, that was a painful couple of days trying to pinpoint this coach. But it was important that we did. We revoked his license. Again, it didn't mean anything back then because nobody required it. Meant something to him. But now it does. And now that the NCAA has required it for the coaches coaching in NCAA certified events, all the NCAA camp coaches, so they're kind of their academy program, are all going to be USA Basketball licensed. And like you said, there are others that are starting to look for it. But yeah, those are some of the best calls we received, despite the despite some of the unfortunate incidents that are being reported. At least now there's accountability to somebody.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that it's just like anything, when you hear about those incidents, obviously those are things that, you know, all of us find disturbing, and we don't want basketball to be associated with that. And we certainly don't want, if we're parents, or, you know, we don't want our kids to be associated with, you know, somebody who's behaving in that way. But to your point, by being able to have somewhere where they can go to say, hey, I observed this behavior, and the fact that they have the respect for USA Basketball and that they know that they can call and you guys took action, you know, that speaks a lot for what we're all trying to do here in the game, which is to make it better for the kids who are playing it. And that's really what it comes down to, is you want to provide the best experience that you possibly can for kids. And I think that the coaching license program is certainly something that, for the coaches who go through it, like you said, it doesn't turn you from a novice coach who's never coached basketball before into someone that we're going to be seeing on TV coaching in the Final Four or in the NBA. But mm-hmm. it certainly allows you to learn some things that can make a difference for an 8, 9, 10-year-old team of kids who are being coached by a parent volunteer or even a coach who has some experience. You're going to learn some great things by going through that program without question.
We hope so.
So let's jump to something else that's coming down the pike that that I really believe in. That's 3-on-3 basketball. Can you talk a little bit about where USA Basketball is going with 3-on-3? Because I think that's another thing that the public maybe isn't quite aware of yet of what's coming. And I'm just a big believer in 3-on-3 basketball for kids in terms of how good it is for their development for a whole bunch of reasons that we can get into. But just talk a little bit about what you're doing with USA Basketball and 3-on-3.
Sure. Yeah, 3-on-3. I mean, we envision the three of us played it at some point, you know, whether it be, you know, at the old outdoor tournaments that they were popping up around the country back in the day, or just informally in our driveways or down at the playground. But FIBA, the International Federation, has formalized it, made it a competition structure, and we're proud to report that it's now in the 2020 Olympic Games. So it's here to stay. And typically when that happens, when a discipline gets into the games, there's a trickle-down effect that you'll probably start to see it formalized at different levels, you know, whether it be college, high school. But we've started to formalize it. And so about 6-7 years ago now, we started our own 3-on-3 program. We held a couple of national championships, one at the U18 level and one at what we call the open division level, men and women, separate competition. The toughest part for us is trying to, so in this country, 3-on-3 basketball is seen more as a training tool for 5-on-5. And there's nothing wrong with that, but 3-on-3 has its own set of rules. So they have a 12-second shot clock, continuous play where you take the ball out of the basket and keep going. No checking the ball up top for after a score. There's no coaching in 3-on-3 basketball, so the players, like Don Showalter, our coach development director, likes to say, you have to figure it out. And they do, and remarkably they do, and we like it from that perspective, because basketball, also as Don likes to say, is overcoached and undertaught, and if you're a teacher of the game, you're going to be able to see it real quick in 3-on-3, because your players will, you'll see how quickly you know your players can do it on their own, and so you know there's a lot of different aspects. Size of the ball is a little smaller, you know, they play on an outdoor court, so they play usually on a sport court. You know, you can't foul out of the game, but you can only have 4 players. So 3 and a sub. So it's really interesting. 3-on-3 fell under the youth division at USA Basketball back in, really like 2014, when there was a vote to get the game, to get the sport into the, 2016 games in Rio. And it fell through because they were having some logistical and building and site issues in Rio at that time. And so what we decided to do was roll 3-on-3 basketball under the youth division to see if we could grow it organically that way. And that was tough. We don't think our country was ready for it. And so you may know this, we changed the name of our division from youth development to youth and sport development because of 3-on-3 and because we run some programs for women as well. And now 3-on-3 is here to stay. And so it's under our division. And it's interesting because we have to, you know, I wouldn't say convince people, but we have to show them that 3-on-3 is a valuable opportunity. As a player, right, you get more touches on the ball. You get to showcase what you can do. Maybe you showcase what you can't do as well. But by and large, you can showcase what you can do, and you can't hide, and you get to play the game. The coaches, I think, are a little, they kind of have, you know, they're squinting through one eye at us, like, is this real? You know, what do I fit in here? And so that's been a challenge as well. But I think you're going to see right after people see it on TV that it's going to take off here domestically. So we can really get into 3-on-3. There's for the United States to get into the Olympic Games, there's a point qualification system, which is not as easy as people think.
That's through FIBA, right?
That's through FIBA, yeah. And only 8 men's teams and 8 women's teams are going to make the Olympic Games. And you do that by virtue of earning points about a year and a half out from the Olympic Games. So We're right in the thick of it right now, trying to earn enough ranking points as a federation to get ourselves in a position to qualify for 2020.
So when you look at the 2020 Olympic team, where is that pool of players being drawn from that's currently playing, trying to qualify the United States into Olympic 3-on-3?
Yeah. Well, if you two are available, we could add you to the mix, but it hasn't been easy. And part of that is because basketball in this country, the popularity of it is a blessing and a curse. On the blessing side, there are so many playing opportunities both here and overseas and for men and women. And it's a curse because as you're trying to put this 3-on-3 initiative together, people are busy playing 5-on-5. And so we have to work in and around what already exists. And what we can say definitively is that NBA athletes won't be allowed to take part in the point earning process, though nor are WNBA athletes. In 2020, FIBA's left the window open so that a couple of players on your team won't have to earn, X amount of points, but they'll have to earn a few points, and perhaps they can be considered at least two of the athletes that weren't part of the circuit, a year and a half prior. So we're excited about that. So that's still an opportunity that may exist. But for the rest of us, we have to take part in the FIBA system. And essentially, that happens the summer, spring, summer, and fall prior to any competition. So last year, it was earning enough points to get into the World Cup. Our men qualified for this year's World Cup, and our women did not, based on that system. So going into next year, we have our work cut out for us. We have to play on this circuit. So the easiest way to say this is you have to get as many players as you can get playing, as many times as they can play, in order to bring the United States points up to a level that we can be in consideration when the determination date is made for who will be in the Olympic Games, which is going to be November 1 of this year.
So when and where is that circuit that these 3-on-3 teams are playing in?
Yep. Up until this year, that circuit had been held primarily internationally in Europe and Asia. The Americas, North or South, we didn't really do much with 3-on-3 in the Americas, aside from our national championship. And the highest point earning events are still happening internationally, although it's starting to change a little. So FIBA created what they call a world tour, kind of like you would see for like a pro volleyball tour, if you will. And people can form teams independently, and they can go out and play in this world tour. And then based on your nationality, you would earn points for your country. So if the three of us and another substitute went and played and we did well, we would earn so many points for playing in that event. But more importantly, we would earn our way to a higher level event for an opportunity to earn more points. And that's right where we're at right now. We have our first, we assembled, we didn't want to rely on the space necessarily to assemble the teams. Although there are a couple of teams in the United States who are very good, who are playing on the circuit right now. But we just assembled the team to get out there and get started on that world tour. And our team right now is made up of a number of athletes that predominantly play in the G League. Some names that you may know: Kenyon Berry, played at Florida and College of Charleston; Sanjay Lumpkin, played at Northwestern; Kadeem Jack, played at Rutgers; John Octius, played at Purdue. Those four guys are en route as we speak down to Brazil to play in the first World Tour event for them for the year. If they do well, they would earn points, and the United States would earn points. And also, more importantly, earn an opportunity to go on to a higher level event where they can earn more points. So that happens between now and September. And then once all that madness is done, then teams that have enough points but then go on to what they call a World Tour Final, which is the highest point earning event. And if you're in that event, you have a really good shot of either qualifying directly for the Olympic Games or qualifying for an Olympic qualifying tournament that would precede the Olympic Games to decide, the last few spots.
If you're a basketball coach in the greater Cleveland area and you have a passion for teaching the game and might be interested in joining the Head Start Basketball Camp coaching staff this summer, please reach out to us via email at headstartbasketball sports@usa.net.
All right, so we're at a high level there with 3-on-3.
Sure.
Obviously, if the game is going to continue to take off and become more visible, which through the Olympics I'm sure it is, then my next question would be, how do we start to get the game more being used more at the youth level?
Yeah.
Is there a vision from USA Basketball for getting more 3-on-3 being played, whether it's through the sponsoring of leagues or USA Basketball 3-on-3 tournaments? What's the plan looking at it from the youth side of it as opposed to the elite side of it?
Yeah. Right now, because there's a U18 component to 3-on-3 at the international level, we've started there. But essentially, we have regional coordinators throughout the country, and they're holding what we would call like 3-on-3 series for people in their area. So basically, they open the gym up, once, twice a week, and they invite players into the gym, and then they form them into 3-on-3 teams each week, and they play a series for 8, 9, 10, 12 weeks. They record all of their results in the FIBA platform, and then the players kind of get to track their point earning as well. But what they don't realize is that they're actually working on their individual skills, probably more so than anything, which is the most important piece to us. So that's happening, and we've piloted that throughout the country for the last 2 years. This is our second year. We will probably formalize that here in the coming months. And so your listeners and folks out there will be able to essentially pick up a 3-on-3 kit, which is essentially, a set of rules, guidelines, how to play, video, things of that nature, where they can buy an official 3-on-3 basketball, stuff like that, and be able to implement either those series in their area. But what we really hope to do at some point here is make a kit that perhaps would allow basketball, 3-on-3 basketball, to be played interscholastically. So, and then the way we envision it is much like high school tennis. So you'd have sort of teams, right? And you would rank your number one, like you'd rank your number one or number
two. Got it. Yeah, that's cool. That's very cool. That is very cool.
Yeah, so that's coming. We don't know if we'll have it for the fall. We're going to try to put it in the hands of a few leagues and see if they'll adopt it. But yeah, so then our schools could play each other, Mike, where, maybe you only have 2 3-on-3 teams and I've got 3. Okay, so you would weight the games as they're played. And then so just because your number one team beats my number one team doesn't mean I couldn't still win the match, if you will, because we could, my number two team might be your number two team or what have you. And so we look at it like that, and we particularly think it's going to be beneficial on the girls' side, where participation in girls' basketball has declined somewhat, as you probably are aware, whether it be tryouts for high school teams or what have you. Girls aren't leaving sports. That's the good news. They just happen to be leaving basketball. That's the not so good news. So, but if you have a 3-on-3 league at the high school level, most schools will be able to field, 1, 2, or maybe even 3 teams, and we think it's great. We think it could be, it has a lot of cost savings. You could commute to the games, perhaps, in a car, as opposed to getting a whole bus. Uniform expenses obviously lower, and one court, you can have 12 people playing at once if you're playing half court on either side. Whereas in a 5-on-5 game, you can only have 10 playing at once. So there's a lot of efficiencies. I don't think event operators have figured out the formula yet to make it work for them financially, but I think it's coming. And once they do, I think you'll start seeing it a little bit more, maybe on the summer circuit as well.
Yeah, I love it. I mean, I love that idea of, I'm just a big proponent of 3-on-3 for kids, because I just think all the things that we've already talked about in terms of skill development, touches on the ball and spacing and all that good stuff. But I had never heard that the potential for it to be, a scholastic event. And I think that's very cool. Would the vision be to have it, I don't want to say replace, but let's say a school would offer 3-on-3 or 5-on-5, or do you think it might be, let's say you're playing your regular 5-on-5 high school season, and then maybe 3-on-3 is a spring sport?
Yeah. Or even like a fall thing. So
gotcha.
The best part about it though is, because of the games are only 10 minutes long, or first to 21, they're so quick. And you're tired when you're done playing.
Right. Oh, yeah.
So you could have like a jamboree where you can have a bunch of schools come in, right? And I'll play on a Friday night or a Saturday, whatever. You can make it a big school thing, too. And you don't have to maybe play twice a week, practice five times a week, whatever. You know, you can actually make it a shortened deal. So, and maybe you just use it as a warm-up as you're getting ready for your five-on-five seasons, because maybe some kids are playing other sports, right? So you're not going to have a full complement of your players. So it's a great way to look at it that way. Again, we have not perfected it, and we haven't even gone out there. We've tentatively run it by a few folks, and I think there's some interest there. But it needs to be piloted and tried out. But it in theory, it should work.
Yeah, I love it. I think it's a great idea. I can see my head's already spinning with some of the possibilities of things that that you could do. I really think it's a great idea. I'd never heard that before in terms of the interscholastic competition. So I love that.
Love that.
All right, I want to ask you about the Her Time to Play program as well, because you've mentioned a couple times what you're trying to do to keep girls involved in the game. So can you talk a little bit about that program, kind of its genesis, and then what it's all about and what the response has been?
Sure. Well, the Her Time to Play program is actually a junior NBA initiative.
Junior NBA, right, yep. Right.
We have a program, and it's a little different. Ours is called Women in the Game. So, you know, kind of semantics, I guess. But the difference would be that Women in the Game is really focused on getting women involved in careers in sport as administrators, officials, coaches, and what have you. Her Time to Play is really more involved in getting young girls to participate in the game on a regular basis. On a playing basis, and the benefits of the health and wellness benefits of and social benefits of playing the game. But good news is we do partner with Her Time to Play. And so we know that program's going really well. They just had started it off, but we are a huge supporter of it. We try to provide mentors and volunteers in our licensed coaches that are women to support the initiative. And it's been successful. And with the NBA's might behind it, you know, 30 teams playing 82 games a year, plus the WNBA teams playing. They're allowed, they have a bigger megaphone certainly than we do, playing once every 4 or 2 years. So we try to support that initiative as much as we can. But on the Women in the Game initiative, that's a program that we started last year. Piloted a couple of years ago, but really started it last year. And what we learned is that as we were starting up our camps and our clinics and our tournaments and our Coach Academy program, when we would go solicit speakers or coaches or clinicians, there was a deficiency in the number of women that were available to us. Not that they weren't, it's just that the pool was a little smaller than it is on the men's side. So when we go to find a great female clinician, you know, they have to be pretty good, number one, and they have to be willing and available. So when you have a smaller pool, you don't maybe get as many women. And so we could complain about it, or we could do something about it. And so we started our Women in the Game initiative to try to encourage more women to get involved in positions in sports so that we can increase the pool, basically. And it's been great. It takes the form of a conference. A day and a half conference where you come out and you listen to different speakers talk about different topics. We have what we call breakfast or lunch pods that the women will get into circles and talk about different issues that affect them and their communities and some of their challenges that they see, maybe trying to get jobs and hired and move up the ranks. The attendees are primarily high school or college aged women. Some young professionals as well, maybe some interns in their first year of work. And then and we also manufacture a game that goes along with that. And what we do, it's an interactive experience. So let's say you want to get involved in event operations. Well, we take you around and show you what it takes to put on a game, from anything from soliciting officials to servicing sponsorships to concessions to ticketing to security. And then the other group will go and follow the coaches, and they'll shadow the coaches of that manufactured game, and they'll take notes, and they have a coaching mentor with them that talks about what the coaches could have done differently or better and the different styles that they either, you know, would want to emulate or not emulate. And so it's been great for us. We partnered this year on our first one of the year with the Golden State Warriors. And so we had great attendance, and they were great partners. They provided some speakers and they sent some people to the conference, and they paid for a few people to go. And then after you leave the conference, there's a mentorship program attached to it, which we're really excited about. We pair women with people that are in women that are in the field with women that are looking to get into the field, and so they serve in a 6 to 8 week mentorship program ongoing through USA Basketball.
Yeah, that's terrific. I know one of the things that I always look at whenever you go to, you know, whether it's a travel tournament, AAU tournament, you see rec league, you just see so few women coaches, especially at the youth level. There's not nearly enough. And I know that, you know, obviously there's a lot of men that are coaching women at, at all levels of the game, but I think that there's definitely something to be said for when you have a female coach coaching females, or even to take it another step further, when you have a female coach coaching males, and that's something that you, you know, you very rarely see. And obviously they're, you know, you're starting to make some inroads in the NBA with
Becky Hammon.
And we just heard, I was just in Chicago for the Junior NBA Leadership Conference, and Jenny Busek from the Mavs was there, and she was one of the clinicians during the second day of the conference. And she was very, very impressive and very good, you know, out there on the floor, and, you know, putting the guys that were there to work for, putting them through their paces. So it was great. It was great to see. It was great to see. And you just don't see it. You just don't see it enough. And I think that any inroads we can make in that area to provide more opportunity for women to get involved in the game obviously helps across all levels, because, you know, they bring a different perspective. It's just a different way of looking at things. And I think that it's great to have role models for all different types of people. And it's, you know, when we only have, when all you see, if you're a young girl and you only see male coaches, you know, you start to look at, well, what's the future for me in this game? Yeah, maybe I can continue to play through, you know, middle school or high school, or if I'm lucky, maybe I can continue to play through college. But there really isn't a path for me beyond that to get into coaching or get into administration. And so for you guys to be able to provide that pathway so that, again, young girls can see that there is a way for me to continue to stay in the game if I love it, I think that's tremendous that you guys are able to do that.
Yeah, and then the other thing we try to do, again, there's a deficiency in the number of women coaching, obviously, and we think it's about maybe, nationwide, the number of women coaching youth sports is only about 14%. Our licensed database, our number of females that we have is closer to 20%, so we're pretty proud of that. Again, like you said, a lot of those women are coaching men, which is good in one perspective, but what we actually look to do at our boys camps is to find women to coach within the boys camps, because then also as young men are seeing women in leadership and coaching positions, that helps change the culture as well, so that they come to start expecting it, and that it's not an anomaly when you see a Becky Hammond or whomever coaching, but it becomes part of the fabric, and that they're there because they're good teachers and good, and, you know, good coaches, and not because, you know, you know, it's the fashionable necessarily thing to do. And so I think changing the fabric of young men's minds too will go a long way to help women's causes in the sport.
And I think you saw that a lot too when they had that first women official ref the NBA. A lot of the guys, a lot of the players didn't have any idea how to go about addressing her, because, you know, I think they're a lot more comfortable now, but I think the first year that she was reffing, you really definitely saw some drastic differences in the way that they reacted and addressed her, because they didn't know what to do.
It was Violet Palmer, and Violet was our first speaker at our first Women in the Game conference. And
that's awesome.
You're exactly right. Yeah, so you couldn't have hit the nail on the head better on that one, because we thought the very same thing, and it was great to have her there to show the attendees, you know, some of the things that she went through to break down some of those walls.
Yeah, it's definitely needed, and I think all those things that we just talked about, I think are key points, because we want to have, again, you're excluding 50% of the population if you're eliminating women from the opportunity to coach and be administrators at a high level or at a low level. Again, I think it's just as important to have women coaching third grade girls and third grade boys as it is to have Becky Hammond coaching on the San Antonio Spurs. It's you're still just as many people are seeing, you know, and being touched by those, you know, those women at those levels. Yeah. Doesn't matter what level you're talking about. So that's tremendous. Yeah. All right. So what are some of the things, I know we've kind of already touched on some of the things that we're moving towards, but if you look 5 years out, what are some of the things that you are hoping to accomplish, or maybe some new things, initiatives that are coming, you know, coming down the pike here, as you look forward 5 years?
Well, so we have a game plan. Okay. And if you were to sort of chunk it out into different categories, you know, we obviously talked about coaches, players is a pretty obvious one. Administrators, I think is one that we were also, you know, dabbling in a little bit too. You know, we talked about going through existing organizations. So we feel like we're on that path. I think there, the two next areas for us would be officials. Hoping to be able to standardize, and I'm not talking high school officials necessarily, but, you know, youth basketball officials, standardizing the way rules are administered. And part of that is standardizing rules and some guidelines, which, as you know, we started that mission in 2016 with the NBA, with a partnership and creating new youth basketball guidelines. We need to take that to the next level. So that'll be a part of that. We think officials will be instrumental in helping us carry that out. But unfortunately, right now, there is no national certification to be a youth basketball official. So when you go to one league, you grab whoever it is and maybe put a whistle and a shirt on them, and they're the youth official, or they're the high school official, right? That's refereeing a youth game on a Saturday. Right. So I think standardization of officials and, of course, rule sets for true youth basketball will be, kind of the next frontier. And then we talked about this briefly. It's parents. What can we do to reach those people that are either driving their children to games, or buying them their basketball sneakers, or paying for their Gatorade, as it were, or whatever the case might be, or paying for them to enter camps or tournaments or clinics or club teams. So we think that there's an untapped opportunity there. I suppose with every opportunity comes a challenge in a lot of cases. So the challenge is obviously identifying them and then getting them to open up to us without us having anything really to hold over them in terms of, like, you know, we can't take away their playing time. We can't pull their license, and nobody needs one to become a parent. So what do we need to do? And that's going to be a real challenge for us. And we'll take all of those 5 years, if you don't mind, to try to.
Absolutely.
But I think by developing good partnerships, we have a great relationship with the NBA, and we think that they will be a great partner. We mentioned they have a megaphone that we don't have, and we think we can get there. And like you said, Mike, we started to see this happen already. We've started to see some parents inquire about more standards, and they want more, and they expect more from their child's coach. That's a good thing. And so hopefully they see us as a resource, and they start to come to us, and that will help with our outreach as well.
Yeah, I think as more people just become aware of the work that you're doing, I think that it becomes easier. It's like you eventually, I think, reach a tipping point where you become more well-known as opposed to being less known, for lack of a better way of saying it. Mm-hmm. And it just becomes the standard that everything is done by and everything is judged by. And so if you're not a USA basketball licensed coach, or you're not a USA basketball licensed tournament, or you're involved in a program that doesn't have USA basketball licensing, I think the goal, and obviously what we'd want to do, is see where parents are looking for that it becomes a stamp of approval. It becomes something that is the standard that people expect. And again, I think we're on the way to that. Like I said, I've seen it grow in the last 3 or 4 years, from where there was almost zero recognition of USA basketball other than what we talked about at the top, the Dream Team and the Olympics. Mm-hmm. And now I think they're starting to become a realization among people that it's more than that. And I think that's a great thing. I want to wrap up by asking you one final question. And that is, if you could wave a magic wand and change one thing about the youth basketball landscape, what would that one thing be that if you could say, all right, I can instantly make this change, what would that one change be?
For me, that one's pretty easy. I think it comes down to changing perspective. And I think that comes down to putting competitiveness into perspective, that we're all not out here to outdo each other, despite, you know, maybe what our civilization has become, that we should all be out here attempting to, you know, get our children involved in sport, whatever sport, basketball or what have you, for the right reasons. And so if I could wave a wand, that would be my, and that is our goal. Which it's going to take a while. We're waving that wand. It's a big wand and we're waving it over a period of time, but it's to change the mindset a little bit from looking up at that scoreboard to decide if today was successful to looking and talking with my child on the way home to decide if it was a fun, successful day for them. And, again, it's a big wand and we're going to need a lot of people to help us wave it. But that would be our goal, and it is our goal, and we'll get there.
Yeah, I love that. I think it goes back to basically covers the entire conversation of what we talked about tonight, because I think you can shift the perspective of the player and why they're playing. I think you can shift the perspective of the coach and why they're coaching and what becomes important to them at different levels. And then obviously, as you just mentioned, you can shift the focus of the parent in terms of what is their child getting out of the game of basketball? What are we using the game to be able to do? And I see it all the time, and I think it was a great suggestion. I think it's a great thing that I would agree with, that if we could change the way people look at what basketball and youth sports are supposed to be about and what they're supposed to do for our kids, not as basketball players, but just as human beings, we would all look at it quite differently. And I think as you go through the process and your kids get older, and you know, I've kind of, not my oldest is now in ninth grade, and as I've gone through it, your perspective does change in terms of what you think they're going to get out of the game and what's important to you that they get out of the game. And it's different for every kid. And unfortunately, we try to put everybody into the same box of, you know, there's some end game that we're all chasing instead of enjoying the experience and using the game as a vehicle to make better people that are going to have a positive impact on society. And I think if we could do that, and that big magic wand that you guys are lifting up and trying to wave over the basketball community, I think is tremendous. Because if we can get there, everybody would be much better off, and also our game would be a lot better off.
Completely agreed. I'm glad we all share the same perspective.
No question. All right. Before we get out of here, Jay, I want to give you a chance to share how people can connect with you, how people can find out more about some of the programs that we talked about tonight. And then if there's anything else that we didn't hit on that you want to share before we wrap things up, you can go ahead and do that now as well.
Well, that's awesome. Mike and Jason, we appreciate the opportunity. And, you know, I think immediately, the two programs that I would, you know, we talked about this before, but we try to impact or reach as many coaches as we can to impact as many kids as we can. So we think our Coach Academy program, which is about to tip off here, it's fifth year now, will kick off in June in Los Angeles. And then we go on to stops in Atlanta and DC and Dallas. And so, and a couple of other stops too. So I would encourage everybody to go to usab.com. to check out a location that's coming to your region. There'll be six of them on the docket this year. We're hoping to spin up, make that eight actually. Those are really great. They're day and a half events where people come and network and listen from to both high level coaches or notable coaches, if you will, and all the way down to coaches coaching in local community middle schools that have all of them have some information to relate both on the court and off the court, X's and O's, strategies and all, but also philosophies and culture talks. And then the second program I would encourage everyone to take a look at, talking about club teams and travel teams. We do run one event every year. It's called the U.S. Open Basketball Championships. This will be our third year. We have run it every year, and we'll be back this year in Westfield, Indiana, at the Pacers Athletic Center. So that'll be July 17th through the 21st. Space is filling up fast, but we have divisions for 12U, 13U, ninth grade and 10th grade. We didn't do a 14U division this year because we're deferring that division to the junior NBA and their junior NBA global championships. And you can also go to usab.com to find out more about both of those programs. So either if it's the US Open, the junior NBA global championships, if you have a team and you're in those age or grade categories, we'd love to have you take part. I think both of us, the NBA and USA Basketball, try to provide a different experience. It's not just about getting your games and going home, but we all have off-court elements and life skills and player cookouts and player appearances and things like that. We try to make it a little different and maybe what some teams are used to, but it is the experience of a lifetime. We want people to experience that difference with us.
Love it. Love it. And can people reach out directly to you, or is they best off going through the USA Basketball website?
Yeah, the best way, well, email us any questions. The email address is youth@usabasketball.com. That's for any program. Our staff here is excellent at getting back and answering questions. The website will provide a lot of answers too, but if there's intricate answers that you need, you can email that youth@usabasketball.com. You can tweet at us. So it's @USABYouth. And we'll get back to you that way as well. And yeah, I think a lot of our programs you can find on our social channels on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, what have you. We're eager. This is a community that we're eager to be a part of. We're wrapping our arms around a community that we haven't been in 40 years. So we try to do that with the player in mind, as our customer, if you will. And so we're excited to hear from anybody and everybody about everything and anything.
Absolutely. Love it. Jay, we can't thank you enough for coming on tonight and spending an hour and 15 minutes or so with us, sharing a lot of great information about what you guys are doing there with USA Basketball. I'm excited to see what the future holds. There's a lot of great programming that you guys are already doing that are going to continue to build. And then some of the new things that we talked about tonight with the 3-on-3 and what's coming with that, I'm super excited about. So thanks for jumping on the podcast tonight with us. We really appreciate it. And to everyone out there, we will catch you on our next episode. Thanks.
Head Start Basketball's Player Development Academy offers Cleveland area players a unique opportunity to improve their basketball skills. Regardless of a player's age, skill level, or position, training with Head Start Basketball will elevate your game to the next level. Do you want to improve your ball handling, become a better shooter, or develop into a more skilled, confident player? Our academy classes offer training that's designed to do just that. Our training sessions are innovative and will have you learning skills that are transferable to actual games. We have 4 different class skill levels for boys and girls, ages 4 and up. All Player Development Academy classes will be held at the Strongsville Recreation Center. For more information or to get registered, please visit www.headstartbasketball.com.
Thanks for listening to the Hoopheads podcast, presented by Head Start Basketball.